Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today I'm talking with Scott St. George from the University of Minnesota, who I met a few years ago when he gave a seminar that I happened to attend with Larry Edwards. And he made some interesting comments about why tree rings are so valuable, more broadly than just for tree ring specialists. A lot of the talk is about those issues and centers around some of the recent controversy with the potential missing rings in the tree ring records. But also it's largely about how Scott found the field of tree ring science and grew into his own interests as a tree ring scientist and had some major early discoveries, for example, on how to use tree rings to assess past flood occurrences. Hopefully at the end of all this, you'll have a better idea about how tree ring science functions, how the chronologies work, why they do appear to be robust. But I also wanted to talk to Scott because he has major interests in fields that are tangential to hardcore physical science. In particular, he's interested in scientific communication and has thought a lot about how to improve scientific oral presentations at meetings. I'm sure you've all attended AGU and EGU and thought to yourself, why can't some of these talks be better? I think Scott has some great ideas about how to conceptualize a scientific talk, how to frame it, and how to pitch it to your specific audience. But he also thinks about how to communicate climate science in other ways than scientists would usually think about. In particular, he's collaborated with musicians at the University of Minnesota and come up with an interesting way of using music to translate a famous climate science graph. On my end, I'm flying on Sunday to go to the CLIVAR Open Science Meeting in Qingdao. If you happen to be around, please do feel free to track me down about the podcast or anything to do with nature. Happy to chat at any time. With that, on to the show. Scott St. George from the Department of Geography, Environment, and Society at the University of Minnesota. Scott, thanks for coming on today.
Hey, Michael. It's my pleasure.
So you're an expert in tree rings, particularly in the use of tree rings to look at past hydroclimate variability, but I thought we'd launch into one of the true abominations of having to be a modern scientist, which is listening to scientific talks. Not all scientific talks, but a lot of them, particularly at big meetings where people are giving 12-minute talks, are pretty difficult to sit through. And you've done a lot of thinking about this. You teach a class called The Art of Scientific Visualization. What are some of the problems that you think are common to scientific presentations, and what advice do you tend to give to people about how to improve their presentations?
The way I think of this is that everybody, all scientists, can do a little bit better. So I think one of the real challenges of being a researcher talking about your work is that you think about this stuff 24/7. And it's really hard to boil that down into a 12-minute talk or a 20-minute talk or an hour-long talk. So I think the biggest problem that all of us have when we're trying to talk about our research is trying to imagine coming to those topics, coming to those problems, coming to those lessons when you're not an expert. So I think one of the things we can do is just show a little bit of empathy.
I think you've hit on one of the big issues that, you know, it was my issue as well, but is trying to tell the audience everything that you've done as opposed to telling the audience one thing that you've done.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really hard because you've spent so much time in the lab, in the field, and I think all of us want to be honest about how we're working through our problems, how we're working through our questions, and we want to share all that detail with somebody else. But you can't cram everything into a short form talk. It's just not possible.
And the people that you're really trying to communicate with in a detail level are your immediate colleagues in the field, and they'll be either reading your papers, reviewing your papers, or working with you. So they don't actually need all the details in the first place.
I think so. The way I think about it, a presentation, it's like the opening statement to an ongoing conversation. You don't need to tell everyone everything about your research right off the bat. You can give them a little bit. And if they're interested, if they want to find out more, they can ask questions. They can go to your paper. They can dig into the supplemental information if they're really keen. But you shouldn't feel the pressure to lay out everything in enormous detail right off the bat.
I think when people do succumb to this pressure, which everyone feels, the things that I see in talks are things like, having too many panels on a graph or unexplained axes or just simply too many words on the slide or having skipped slides that they don't even go through in the talk or miniature fonts or just the excess use of jargon.
We have a lot of bad habits. I think I was really lucky because I happened to go through my graduate degrees working with people that were senior scientists who were very effective communicators that spent a lot of time thinking about how to get across their main point to other scientists and to broader audiences. But I think a lot of us also feel a little bit, I don't know, insecure maybe. We want to make sure that other scientists know how much effort, how much care we've put into our analyses. So we want to build this wall in front of us of our data, our slides, our all the points we want to make. And I think we have to realize that nobody really wants to get all that detail at once.
So what advice do you give to people in this class or in your presentation about the five things you can do to make your talk just a little bit better?
The thing that I say at the beginning before I start giving any suggestions about how to improve a talk is that everybody, senior scientists, junior scientists, graduate students, need to be a little bit forgiving of themselves. Nobody gives a perfect talk. So the first thing is you don't need to be perfect to give a good talk. You can act like a human being and still be a good scientist. You don't have to be a robot. The real first piece of advice I give people is just to think about your audience. Who are they? If you're giving a presentation at the American Geophysical Union, that audience may be made up of experts in your field and in related disciplines and other forms of earth sciences. And that's very different than if you go to the Association of American Geographers, which is made up partially of scientists, but also people working in the social sciences and sometimes the humanities. And those are different audiences, and you have to tailor what you're saying at least a little bit to the real people that are in front of you. I think sometimes, especially when junior scientists give a talk, they worry about that one person in the back who's a senior scientist, who's a big deal in their field, and they think, I'm going to give a talk that's going to impress that person. And in doing so, they alienate everybody else, and they forget about everybody else.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think, you know, it's okay, especially if you're talking about a technical subject, it's okay to get right into the details and explain what you mean in very specific terms. But I think people should take a step back and just remember that not everybody is ready to jump into the deep end right off the bat. And it's always nice if you can give everyone in the room a broader overview. So everybody walks out with a little something.
One framing device that you almost never see, but it's a fixture of journalism, is to begin the presentation with the main conclusion. And in a lot of talks, what you see instead is that the concluding material is jammed into 10 seconds at the end, and they often don't even have time to go through it. So do you think it's effective to begin with your main point?
I think it's a great idea to start with the most important thing. Studies of attention span have shown over and over again that the most attention you're going to get from that audience is in the first minute or two. I think we should make best use of that minute or two and get to the point by essentially saying, this is what I want to share about past climate change. If you listen to nothing else in my talk, remember this.
In addition to all of your work on tree rings and visualization, you also have an interesting collaboration with musicians at the University of Minnesota to try and bring some of the visual information in climate records into the musical realm. How is that collaboration going, and what's been the outcome?
You know, I teach a very large undergraduate class on the introduction to environmental sciences at Minnesota. And every year I spend a week talking about climate change to about 500 students from all ranges of majors, business, engineering, chemistry. And every year I put up a graphic produced by the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, and I show them how temperatures have changed from 1880 up to today. And I always feel like that graphic, or the way I present that graphic to my students, is a little bit underwhelming. You know, I throw this graph up and it starts low and it steps up a bit, and then over the last 30 years it really takes off. It's pixels on a screen. And I feel like the message that data has to convey is so important that just flashing up a graphic for a few minutes on a screen in front of some students who might be a little drowsy from the day before or are thinking about other things,
or their brains just don't click with two-dimensional graphs.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've looked at that graphic year after year after year for maybe a decade and a half now. And so I look at it and I can see every year something new that I didn't see before. But for most people, they look at that and it's outside of their day-to-day experience. And so I thought maybe we could try other ways of communicating the same information and reach people in a different way, or maybe reach different people. So for the last couple of years, I've been working with some undergraduate students at the University of Minnesota to take that same data that NASA produces every year, documenting the changes in temperatures across our planet. But instead of preparing a graphic that shows that information, I've asked students to take that data and turn it into musical sound.
And when you brought them this project, did they say, this is crazy? Or did they say, yes, let's do it?
I hired this undergraduate student to work in our tree ring lab within the Department of Geography. And I hired him just to work at the microscope and look at tree ring samples. But I also knew from his CV that he played bass and he played cello. So a few months after we hired him, I said, I have this idea. Do you think you could take this set of numbers and turn them into music? And he thought about it for a moment. He said, yeah, I think I can do that. And he went away. He came back the next weekend and he played me a MIDI recording that he'd done on his keyboard. And it sounded exactly like I imagined. So we took that. He recorded it on his cello at the University of Minnesota School of Music using some professional recording gear and their support. We made a video about it and we released it online. This 2-minute or 3-minute composition that plays the global temperature record as if it was a series of notes.
And it got a lot of coverage.
That really shocked us. You know, we thought we'd release this thing online, this odd little composition based on climate data, and maybe a few people would check it out. Maybe our parents would look at it on Facebook, something like that. But I think the first day we got 10,000 hits. And within a day or two, my student, who's a guy named Dan Crawford, he was doing interviews with National Public Radio. He was getting calls from the UK. Within a week or two, he was showing up on the Japanese equivalent of Entertainment Tonight, talking about this music composition that he did based on NASA's global temperature record. So I think accidentally we stumbled on a really good idea. And I think the main lesson that we learned was that there are a lot of possibilities to take data, take lessons or stories from science and try and communicate them in a slightly different way. And if you can come up with something that's a little bit different, a little bit odd, a little bit surprising, some people will pay attention. It's worth experimenting.
Before you got interested in the art of scientific presentation, you grew up in Winnipeg, in sort of southeast central Canada, and then stayed there for your undergraduate degree. How did you find growing up in that part of Canada to be, and why did you choose to stay in the area for your undergrad?
You know, Winnipeg is a northern prairie metropolis, right? It's a city of about 800,000 people. It's a long way from other places. So I think people that grow up in this part of Canada are used to the idea of hopping in the car and driving for 5 hours to go visit someone or see a hockey game or something like that. I think growing up, Winnipeg felt like a long way away from everything, which is true. This, you know, this is there's big distances here.
But a lot of times when that happens, then someone coming out of high school would want to leave that kind of isolation and go to a different country or a different city. You chose to stay. What was keeping you there?
Well, I think that's pretty typical. I know I have a lot of friends who did their undergraduate and graduate degrees in the U.S. And I remember when I first moved down to Arizona to do my PhD, I was really surprised at how much so many of my friends had moved around. People from the Northeast had gone to school somewhere in Texas or the West Coast and vice versa. You know, there's not the same diversity of institutions. You know, there's not the range of state schools, the Ivy Leagues, community colleges that there is in the U.S. and Canada. Mostly the quality of the education is basically the same from one institution to another. So when I was trying to make my choice about where to go to school, there were two universities within my home city. One of them was a 2-hour bus ride away from my parents' house, and the other one was in a 1-hour bus ride every day, and that made things an easy choice. I think that realistically, that was pretty much it. Which one could I access? Which one was closest?
You never thought about going to Toronto or Victoria. It just didn't make enough sense to disrupt your life that much to go to a, an approximately similar university.
I would have never imagined that. I didn't know, you know, I didn't really know anybody who had been to university. I had a great uncle. My mom's uncle was a medical doctor, but he and his family lived out on Vancouver Island. So we didn't see them that often. So I didn't really know anyone who'd gone to university before. And certainly everybody that I grew up with and went to high school with went to either the University of Winnipeg or the University of Manitoba. I don't think I really knew anybody who made any other choices besides that.
What did your parents do?
My dad was in the Canadian Army for a long time. He originally joined when he was 15. And then they found out he was 15 and kicked him out. And then he signed up again when he was 18 and was stationed over in Korea and Germany and a few other places in Europe.
What did he do for those 3 years?
I think he was driving a taxi cab, an unlicensed taxi cab in his hometown. So he was not letting the grass grow under his feet. He went to a career as a military police and then a police officer and then into a career in security after that. And my mom was a teacher, both at the elementary school level and in high school, before she had me.
So for her, at least, it wouldn't have seemed strange for her son to be going off to college, and probably for your father as well. Were they supportive of your interest in geographical sciences when you got into that as an undergrad? Did that seem like a good idea to them?
I had a lot of freedom. And again, I didn't really have a plan or a lot of other people to talk to. And I remember in my high school yearbook, I wrote, when they asked what I wanted to be when I grew up, for some reason, I wrote, I wanted to be a geologist. Huh. And I found that, in retrospect, I find that really strange because I didn't know anyone who was a geologist and I didn't know what that was. But for some reason, that popped into my imagination at that point. One of my cousins on the West Coast was an archaeologist, and I got to go and visit him when I was about 10 years old, which was the same year that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I dragged my mom to see that about 4 times. So being able to meet my cousin and visiting his apartment where he had a real human skull sitting on his coffee table, that really fired up my imagination.
And then you stayed in Canada for your master's degree at the University of Western Ontario, where you worked in Banff and Jasper. It looks like doing reconstructions of summer temperatures from tree rings. How did you begin to ooze into tree ring research at that point?
I wanted to go to the mountains. Winnipeg is on the prairies. It's on the southern prairies. For those people who haven't been there, you might be imagining a flat place, but Winnipeg in southern Manitoba is beyond flat. It's located right in the middle of the former basin of Glacial Lake Agassiz. Mm-hmm. So the only thing here that we have is agricultural fields and sky. So I wanted, when I had the chance to go away to graduate school, I didn't really know what I was getting into for graduate school. Maybe we can get some kind of indication of past changes in moisture, but floods occur over a span of a couple of weeks, or a few weeks at least. They're just too fast-acting to leave a permanent imprint on trees, and especially the floods in this part of the Northern Plains. They're not flash floods. They're the opposite of flash floods. They're really slow events that come up and then fall over the span of several weeks or a month and a half. So I didn't think there'd be enough physical energy associated with those floods to actually damage the trees or leave any evidence behind.
But you would have a situation where the rooting zone would be completely inundated for a long period of time.
Yeah. But at that point, I didn't think, and no one had really shown, that would be enough to leave behind some kind of permanent marker within the trees.
Was your job then to go and look at hundreds of tree rings, knowing exactly in which ring the flood did occur, because you had the perfect chronology, and then just looking for anomalous signs?
Eric, for years, had been collecting tree ring samples from historical buildings in Winnipeg and the rest of the region. He'd been pulling logs out of the river. And I remember my first day of work almost, I showed up to meet him, and he took me over to the core storage warehouse where the Provincial Survey kept most of their geological samples. And there were just pallet after pallet after pallet of these tree ring samples that he'd been collecting for years and never had a chance to analyze.
Just like in the storage scene and the last part of Indiana Jones?
Yeah. Except that they smelled bad and they were wet, especially the ones that were pulled out of the river. So for the next few months, my job was to go through each of those samples, look at the patterns of the rings, try and assign calendar dates to each of them, and build up a regional tree ring chronology so that we could then look for evidence of past floods. And while I was doing that, I kept seeing these weird rings. So at the time, I had no idea where in the timeline any of these samples fell. They were, you know, they were from old buildings. They were logs pulled out of the river. But I kept seeing these unusual rings. It was the first time I'd ever worked with oak trees. And oak trees have a more sophisticated anatomy than conifers do. So something like a spruce tree or pine tree, essentially when you put it under the microscope, you just see one type of cell making up the annual ring. But oaks are more sophisticated. They have separate structures for nutrient transport. There's a lot more variety in what you see under the microscope within the ring. And I kept seeing this weird ring that was a different color and had a different mix of anatomical features. And I kept thinking, that looks weird.
Always a good sign.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sound of scientific progress, right? That looks weird. About a couple months later, I think it was in October, I finally had dates for all the samples and was able to line up each of them in time using the pattern in the rings. And when I went back to those weird rings we were seeing with the odd anatomy, they all showed up in the same year, and that year was 1826. That was a real eureka moment, because 1826 was known from historical records as the biggest flood that had occurred within the last 200 years. There was no contemporary evidence of it, but there were early fur trading posts that were built in Winnipeg and very extensive descriptions of that flood. So the fact that we could pull up one of these tree ring samples and put our finger on 1826 and see this permanent record of that flood, that was really powerful.
That must have been an amazing moment when you realized that it worked.
I've never been so happy to be so wrong. A lot of what I've done in my career reflects the particular story that was recorded by those set of oak trees. They really deserve the credit for that flood record that we were able to build.
Sometime while you're still at the Geological Survey, you decided to return to graduate school, but it looks like you kept your affiliation with the society while you went to grad school at the University of Arizona. Were you sort of sponsored to go back to school to increase your level of education and have opportunities for advancement or more responsibility in the agency?
At the time when this flood project was ending, the Geological Survey of Canada was also investing in research focused on climate change, climate impacts, the impact of climate change on natural resources and natural hazards.
This must have been pre-Harper.
I was actually right at the beginning, but before the policy changes had been made.
Before the reforms.
Yeah, before the changes really started coming down. Government agencies are a big ship. They don't change that fast. So at this time, climate change was still a major plank within the science portfolio of the Geological Survey of Canada. I was really lucky. I knew I wanted to go back to graduate school. I knew I wanted to do a PhD in part because that was going to be important for me to continue to build my career at the survey, because almost everybody else I worked with had a PhD as a research scientist. So I was given the opportunity to take kind of a leave of absence. I went down to part-time and moved down to Arizona, where I could complete my PhD at the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, which is Mecca for dendrochronology.
Did you consider Lamont at all, or did you know you wanted to go to Arizona?
Lamont was my second choice, or my other choice, and I was really attracted to Lamont because Ed Cook, who's a very senior paleoclimatologist who is one of the people who built the tree ring lab at Lamont. Ed has always been extremely gracious to me. Even as a master's student, he went out of his way to be encouraging and supportive. So I was really tempted by the idea of going to Lamont. But I'd also been outside of school for a while. I'd spent 4 years working in government, working for the Geological Survey of Canada. And I was attracted to go to Arizona in part because their graduate program was a little more structured than what I imagined the program at Lamont was. So for that reason, I decided to go down to Arizona. And also, I'd never ever lived in a place that didn't have snow. So moving down to Arizona was a chance for me to experience a very different kind of lifestyle.
When you were there, you worked with Jonathan Overpeck and Julio Betancourt and Mike Evans, some of the real leaders in the field in climate change and in tree ring research. When you got in that kind of a crowd, people who were the leaders of a scientific community, did anything change about your worldview on science, or was it pretty much like working with people at the Geological Survey who are also at the top of their field?
It was intimidating. And I remember not necessarily being intimidated by people like Peck or Julio or Dave Miko, who is my PhD advisor. I found the graduate students to be very intimidating at the start, huh, because they'd all come from these very competitive undergraduate and graduate programs. They had already had, in some ways, a more complete education about certain things than I did. So, you know, I mentioned that paleoclimate geology was not really part of my undergrad in a major way. So going to Tucson, going to the University of Arizona, being in a geosciences department, I think that reminded me that there were some important areas of the earth sciences where I'd never taken a class.
Like climate dynamics or something like that.
Or geochemistry. So being around people like Jay Quaid and some of the other top geochemists at Arizona, you know, they were talking about things that I'd never heard of before.
Isotopes.
Yeah, or if I had heard, I just knew a little bit about it. I remember meeting one of the other graduate students, one of the new PhD students, and he told me that he worked with isotopes. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. I was just reading this paper about how you can use stable isotopes to trace the origins of archaeological timbers associated with the Anasazi. And I think he paused a moment, and then he said, yeah, that was me. I did that. And, you know, now we're good friends. And I talk to Nathan quite often about things related to stable isotopes because he's a wonderful resource. Going down to Tucson, it was very intense. I really enjoyed that. Most of the people in graduate school were coming from other places. So most of us didn't know anybody in Tucson. We were forced to, in some ways, become friends and spend all of our time together. And I think it was also really lucky because the graduate students there were all very smart and capable people that took their work very seriously. But they also had a sense of humor about themselves and were more inclined to cooperate with each other than try and compete and elbow into each other.
So you felt a bit stretched, but you liked that feeling.
Yeah, I think that was healthy for me to learn about different fields that I'd never been exposed to. I mean, I was also lucky because while I was working for the survey on the Red River Flood Project, I had the opportunity to publish a lot and to be lead author on a lot of the contributions. So I think that was really lucky for me because the senior scientists I was working with up in Manitoba were willing to let me take the credit for some of the work that we were doing together. I know now that that's not universal. Not everybody acts that way.
Yeah, that's very kind.
Yeah, that gave me a little bit of a basis to be confident that I could get some things done while I was down in Arizona.
After your PhD at Arizona, it looks like you returned a little bit, probably full-time to the survey, but then moved on to your faculty position where you are now. You just got tenure in 2015. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
What made you decide to leave government service and look for an academic position out of the country, out of Canada?
Leaving my position at the GSE was a really tough decision. I loved working there, and I think I'm really proud of the things that we accomplished, building paleoclimate records of floods and drought in southern Manitoba. I was lucky to work with some really wonderful people that I still keep in touch with regularly. But at the end of 2007, 2008, I think I realized that I was a scientist working for the Government of Canada in the area of climate change science. And that was going to pose a challenge for me because opportunities to do that kind of research going forward were going to get narrower. At that time, the GSC was winding down its climate change program, and it was clear that they were not going to launch a follow-up to that initiative. So I wasn't going to be able to do a lot of the work that I wanted to do. So I think I saw the writing on the wall and had the opportunity to move down to Minnesota in 2010. And it was a hard choice to leave Canada. I liked living in Ottawa. I liked the colleagues that I was working with. But I think ultimately it was the right decision because within a year or two, the GSC had eliminated at least a few units that were dedicated to climate change. They had a fairly large ice core group that was there for several decades that was eliminated, I think, in 2011, 2012. And as someone who worked in the area that was kind of similar to what my colleagues in ice core studies were doing, that made me feel better about my decision to leave.
I guess I must have seen you give a talk at the University of Minnesota fairly soon after you arrived. I was visiting Larry Edwards there, a paleoclimate scientist, and he took me to a seminar in someone's house whose name I forget, but apparently a famous seminar series.
Herb Bright. Herb passed away last year, but he was a longstanding faculty member in the Department of Geology. And for years, Herb would host a lecture series in his living room. I can't remember how many people were there the night you were there.
Maybe 20.
He would have 20, 30 people pulling up chairs out of the basement. They'd take a painting off a wall, and project some slides, and you'd spend about an hour together talking about some aspect of quaternary paleoecology, and drinking beer and having cheese and hanging out.
It was definitely one of the most fun seminar series I've ever been to. But what struck me at that talk, and I realize this is a completely idiotic thing to say, but I had actually never thought about it before. You made the comment that one of the main things that gives tree rings their claim to fame is an age model uncertainty of plus or minus 0 years. And of course, this is the biggest issue in many other fields of paleoclimatology. And of course, tree rings have this claim to fame. At that time, there was this swirling debate about whether or not the tree ring chronology was off a little bit. Can you talk about the origins of that controversy and how the community has or hasn't worked through those issues now?
I'm glad you remember that from my talk.
See, I remembered one thing.
Yeah. I feel like I did something with that. You put it in a very useful way. You know, tree rings have a claim to fame that we have a perfect age control, or at least correct within plus or minus 0 years. One of the things that I've realized is that my community, my discipline, you know, our group of tree ring scientists have maybe not done a good job explaining how we create a tree ring chronology to other scientists. So I think one of the things that, I don't know, maybe is easy to forget, that we have to keep explaining how we build a record from the rings of ancient trees to people that are coming to it for the first time. A lot of people will assume that you build a tree ring chronology by counting the tree rings, like counting a stack of plates. The thing I try and repeat when I'm talking about the method of building our tree ring record is that we don't count. We date patterns. We don't just count the rings. We start by looking at the rings, but in order to create a reliable chronology, we match the patterns of wide and narrow rings across first two pairs of neighboring trees, and then other trees within the same area, and then trees from one location to another location, eventually building up this kind of barcode in time that tells us how tree growth for different species in different places changes year after year, decade after decade, century after century. And because we match patterns and not count rings, that allows us to correct mistakes, errors that always creep in when somebody misidentifies a ring or identifies two rings or one ring, or deals with the situation where a tree doesn't form a ring within a particular year because that tree is being attacked by an insect infestation or because it's a really cold year. I think one of the things that the tree ring community needs to remember is that not everybody knows how we work. And it's helpful to talk to people like you and other climate scientists and be more explicit, more clear about walking other people through the way that we pull these tree ring records together.
Then why was it such a bombshell when there was this suggestion that there might have been a fundamental offset in the tree ring chronologies?
Well, I think it cuts the core of what we think of as the main asset, the main advantage of tree ring records, that absolute calendar date. So when we tell you that a flood in Winnipeg happened in 1826, it was 1826. It could not have been 1825. It could not have been 1827. The only date that's possible is 1826. That certainty is very powerful because then it allows us to make comparisons between one record from one area, another record from another, to try and understand whether things happened at the same time or whether one event led the other or followed the other. So in 2012, Mike Mann and a couple of his colleagues came out with a paper in Nature Geosciences that essentially said we have a problem. And that problem is that tree ring estimates of past changes in temperature over the Northern Hemisphere don't match the estimates that we get from climate models over the same time period. And that mismatch, that disagreement between the tree rings and the models, is most evident, it's biggest in the years following major volcanic eruptions,
which are known to have cooling effects.
Yeah, not just the small ones, but the really big ones. Krakatau, Tambora, Kauai, the biggest eruptions within the last 1,000 years. So Mann was arguing that there was a discrepancy between the level of cooling indicated by the trees and the more severe cooling inferred from the models. Now, the solution that they presented within this paper was to argue that the cooling had been so severe, basically that the models were right and that these major volcanic eruptions created so much cooling that trees that were growing in places where a temperature would be the main factor controlling their growth, places like the boreal forest or high up on mountain peaks, those trees would be under so much environmental stress because of the cold conditions that all of them would fail to form a ring. And if all of them failed to form a ring, then the method that tree ring scientists use to build their chronology, to set their timeline, our methods would fail. Because if the ring is not present in any of our trees, we wouldn't be able to appreciate that it's not there. And that would introduce chronological error. So instead of a ring forming in 1815, that ring would actually be 1814. If the tree ring record was offset by a year, or 2 years, or 3 years, depending on how far back you go in time, that would call to question a lot of the conclusions that have been drawn from the use of tree rings as proxies and as tools for archaeological dating. If the chronology is wrong, then you have to call to question almost any kind of scientific product that depends on tree ring data.
It would have been a pretty big revision.
Yeah. And one that had no parallel ever before in the history of dendrochronology, a science that goes back more than 100 years in some places. We've never changed the time scale. This paper came out and it got a lot of attention in the news. And I think initially the feeling I had was I didn't think it was right, but it didn't really bother me that much either. So I probably would have let things lie, except I had this master's student who had just started. His name was Max Torbenson. He's now a PhD candidate at the University of Arkansas working with Dave Staley. And Max read this paper and he got really mad about it because he did his undergraduate degree at Queen's University Belfast, the lab that had developed some of the very long records from Irish oak collected from Northern Ireland and elsewhere. His initial training as an undergraduate student was in tree ring dating. So the idea that the tree ring dates could be wrong, that really pushed his buttons. So for about a week, I would come into the lab and talk to Max, and Max would explain that he was still upset about this idea that the tree ring dating could be wrong. And then we started talking about this problem, and we started discussing, why do we think this is wrong? Why do we think that the tree ring chronology is correct and you can't make any revisions?
Just beyond the emotional reaction, you're actually trying to probe the mechanisms that could or couldn't account for this.
Yeah, and we started to construct thought experiments based on Mike Mann's hypothesis. So if all the rings were missing for 1816, what would be the consequences of that? What would we see in the tree ring records? Would we see it everywhere? We would see it all trees? Which trees would we expect to see missing rings? Which ones would we expect not to see that? And I think as soon as Max and I started talking about this, a switch went off in my brain where I realized we didn't really know that much about rings that are missing. It's something that you deal with whenever you're building a tree ring record. You have to be careful and watch out for individual trees that don't form a ring in a particular year and match that pattern against their neighbors.
So it's not outrageous to suggest in principle that there would be missing rings in trees.
They definitely exist. It's been known probably since, I think, the 1920s that under severe environmental stress, some trees will skip a ring. And they're not really skipping a ring. It's just that the cambium right at the base of the tree, where we usually collect our samples, doesn't get activated. There's a ring for that year, but it's somewhere higher up in the canopy, closer to the top of the tree. And it's just at the bottom of the tree where we take our core sample that ring is not present.
So the first thing that would occur to me, if this is right, that it's systematically missing in very high elevation or cold trees, would be to look at a mountain with a large elevational gradient and look for a gradient in the presence or absence of tree rings.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things we talked about was starting at the base of a mountain, relatively warm conditions, and then sampling higher and higher up the peak. You'd expect that under really cold conditions, the ones at the top would suffer first and be more likely to form missing rings. And in dry environments, that's exactly what you see. As you move down the forest in places like Arizona and New Mexico, climate gets hotter and warmer. So as you move down from mountaintops and in places like the Southwest, the frequency of missing rings in trees starts to get more and more common. So we know that environmental gradients change the likelihood that certain trees are going to suffer in this way and fail to form a ring. It started to be really educational because, you know, I started talking with Max and I said at some point, you know, I've never seen a missing ring in any of my samples. And that was true. You know, most of my research has been done in places like the Northern Canadian Rockies, Central Ontario, places that are kind of benign as far as environments for trees to grow. But I knew that friends of mine who were doing their PhD work and other research down in Arizona, they would struggle over weeks trying to deal with very common missing rings in moisture-stressed pines in places like New Mexico, where a tree could be missing a ring, sometimes almost one out of every 10 rings.
Wow.
You know, really tough stuff. And meanwhile, I'm sitting dating my fat ring trees from northern Ontario and wondering why it's taking everybody else so long. I was just lucky. I was working in a place where environmental stress is not that significant. The trees form a ring every year without fail. And the same thing with the oaks that I would work with when I was doing the flood project in Winnipeg. You know, I think we looked at 600 trees in that sample. I never saw any missing rings. So then I started talking to a few colleagues, Neil Peterson, who's at Harvard Forest, and Kevin Anchikaitis, who's down at Arizona now, just trying to get a sense of how common are these things. You know, it's something that we deal with all the time, but we never report it in a paper because it's just part of doing business, building the chronology. So once I figured out that we didn't really have a handle on how often trees form locally absent rings, a colleague and I decided to get as much tree ring data as we could and just map it out. Count all the zeros, the marker that people use to represent rings that are missing within tree ring sequences. And what we found was that in boreal forests, when you're looking at trees that are spruce or larch, which make up most of the tree ring samples in places like northern North America or northern Eurasia, those species, those genus, almost never form missing rings.
Even in the coldest of years, they're still forming a detectable ring.
In all the cases we looked at, hundreds of cases across North America, Europe, and Asia, we never saw any case where a ring was missing from all the trees at a single location.
What would be the highest percent missing rings you would have in any one location in an exceptionally cold year?
It varies by species. And I think what we saw was spruce trees would get up to, I think the highest number was around 27%. So 27% of all the spruce trees within a given forest stand didn't form a ring in a given year.
But that's an outlier on the high end.
That's the highest that anybody's ever reported anywhere. Larch, it was a little bit higher. I think there was one case where all the trees at a site in Mongolia were reported to have a missing ring, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But those were only two. There were only two trees in the record at that point. Not that many. What we came to think of with the connection back to the controversy was that if Mike Mann's hypothesis was right, and these cold years following major volcanic eruptions really did trigger very large areas, sort of country-sized areas in the boreal forest to shut down, that would require behavior that we've never seen anywhere at any single location ever to happen almost everywhere simultaneously. I don't think that's likely, given what we know about how that species responds to stress. I mean, basically, spruce trees are adapted to cold weather. You know, if you hit Engelmann spruce with a cold summer condition, it can handle that better than almost any tree species on the planet.
From what you're saying, it sounds like the paper stimulated a great deal of fruitful research that had the net impact of the community saying that they didn't feel there was a need to adjust the chronologies.
I think you're right. Ultimately, the impact of that paper was to force my community to think really hard about how we know things or why we hold certain things to be true. And it has sparked some people to look at the chronological integrity of tree ring records in different and really interesting ways. There have been a series of papers that have identified these radiocarbon spikes.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Globally.
The C14 spikes.
Yeah, that are believed to be associated with some kind of extraterrestrial cause, like a solar flare or something really intense that comes from off planet that temporarily boosts up the production of radiocarbon across the whole planet. And then that radiocarbon or that greater fraction of radiocarbon finds its way into the rings of trees for a couple of years everywhere globally. And I remember when I first heard that reported, that it was a study that was based on some, I think, a couple of cedar trees.
In Japan.
In Japan. And I remember looking at that paper thinking, well, how can you really be sure that this is a global signal if you just have two trees from one place? Maybe there's just something odd about that particular spot. I was totally wrong about that, because it's that same spike has been identified in Germany and New Zealand, in Arizona, and now is giving us an additional geophysical dating tool that we can use to, in most cases, well, so far, corroborate the calendar that we get from matching patterns in tree rings.
You know, and honestly, when my colleague Leslie Sage and I saw that paper coming into Nature, neither one of us had any idea how important it was going to be for the tree ring and paleoclimate community.
Yeah, well, you know, it didn't have anything to do with tree ring dating. They were really just looking for evidence of, you know, some kind of exceptional extraterrestrial behavior. But it's turned out to be a really neat way for the tree ring community to corroborate this century-long method of matching patterns in the width of trees across the planet.
One of the main reasons that I think tree ring research has been so useful, both within the community and broader societally, is its ability to contextualize climate variability. So putting modern climate variability within the context of what we know has happened over the past centuries to millennia from tree rings. And what you've worked on, at least to some extent, is trying to understand how this recording system of decadal to centennial variability changes by species and by location. And I'm curious to know if you think that there are particular questions that you think the tree ring science has really nailed in terms of contextualizing this decadal to centennial variability, and if there are other topics that you think are still important but cannot be answered at present with tree ring science.
I think we know best, in many respects, the reasons why certain trees in certain geographical locations or certain ecological settings are tuned to different parts of the climate signal. And I think we know that in part because we have a strong theoretical foundation. There's a fellow named Hal Fritz, who's an emeritus professor at the University of Arizona. And in the early 1960s, Hal wrote a series of articles, in I think one in Science, one in quaternary research, looking at the state-of-the-art network of tree ring records in the early 1960s. Which I think it numbered around 40, 45 records available to Hal in the Western United States and Western Canada. And from this very small network of tree rings, he set out a set of principles that he believed should explain why, for example, trees in the Southwest primarily record winter precipitation. Even though they grow during the summer, they depend on moisture that's being supplied from the previous winter. And he also pointed out, you know, essentially not with very much data, maybe with two or three or four sites, that trees that are growing close to altitudinal or latitudinal tree line, you know, cold limited forests, should primarily be recording evidence of past changes in temperature. They shouldn't care about moisture because they should have sufficient moisture supply really every year, but they'll be tuned to a different window, a different part of the climate signal. And I think one of the things that we've been able to map in the last 4 or 5 years is this real signal that is encoded within now the very wide and extensive hemispheric or global network of tree ring records. So compared to the 40 or 45 records that Hal had access to in the 1960s, now everyone has access to maybe 2,000 or 3,000 records across very different types of species, and locations and climatology. What really amazes me about that is that these very simple principles that Hal set out very early on in the history of quantitative dendrochronology have proven by observations to be absolutely spot on. For that reason, we have a very good handle on why certain aspects of terrestrial climate show up in some trees, while other trees are tuned to something very different than that. I think we're struggling to understand how those local climate records or the patterns that we get from larger compilations of tree ring networks, how terrestrial records from trees connect to what the atmosphere is doing or what the ocean is doing. One of the limitations about tree rings is that they're all on land. So if you're going to use a tree ring record to make an estimate of something like ENSO or what the North Atlantic is doing, or these broader scale patterns within the atmosphere and ocean, sometimes we can map out an association between a set of tree rings in a region and one of these particular forcings. So, for example, in the Southwest, there's a wonderfully clear ENSO signal in drought-sensitive trees in northern Mexico and the American Southwest.
But in other areas, that connection might be temporarily unstable.
Right, because those relationships are mediated through the atmosphere and local climate, in some cases, local hydrology and soil conditions and forest demographics. So as soon as we start walking up the chain of causation from the immediate growth environment of the tree to broader scale regional climate to possibly remote forcings associated with teleconnections, that makes things more difficult. And we have to be very careful about how we make those comparisons.
So at the macro level, one use of tree ring science is trying to develop this broad-scale environmental record that can be linked to past variability in atmospheric circulation and state, which can then be used to constrain the behavior or the selection of the most appropriate climate models looking at future climate. And what I think you're saying is that that connection between the broader patterns of tree ring variability and the atmospheric dynamics is still a work in progress.
And I think one of the problems we're wrestling with right now is that because of the cumulative blood, sweat, and tears of so many people going out and developing tree ring records at so many different locations across the planet, we now have this very large sensor network. We have this very large network of tree ring records over the Northern Hemisphere, especially. And that is a wonderful asset because it gives us so many opportunities to compare tree growth and different locations against other aspects of the climate system. But it also comes at a cost because then we need to make choices about which of those comparisons are appropriate and what scale we should make those comparisons. So I think one of the things that we need to think about is how we'd expect the effects or the imprint of particular aspects of the climate, like ENSO. How would we expect ENSO to be evident within a network of tree ring records?
And that takes you into forward modeling.
That's one way of doing it, trying to propagate some estimate of the climate impact of the forcing and then translate that into a modeled output of tree growth. But in some ways, it also leads us to trying to come up with a almost like a philosophical framework for those comparisons. Mm-hmm. So given a very large network of tree ring sensors across a very large area like North America, given of an external forcing like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which we know has an impact on North American climate, how would you expect the PDO to be expressed across that network? Where should you see a signal? Where would you expect not to see a signal? What kind of trees? What kind of climate? I think that's something that doesn't have a clear answer right now.
You're almost getting into some of the, as you say, philosophical questions about multiple comparisons in statistics. In other words, what's the burden of proof that you have in order to say that something has happened in an important way?
And what do we expect? How do we imagine these things could be connected? If we see a positive result or a negative result, what does that tell us at the individual level? How does that individual case fit in within the context of all the possible evidence that we could consider?
And I know that you and Anshu Chatterjee have a new NSF grant to look at this exact topic, I believe, and you're heading off for a sabbatical on a Humboldt Research Fellowship for Experienced Researchers working with Jan Esper and Eduardo Zorita. So it sounds like you have an exciting topic for the next year and 3 years with the NSF grant.
Well, I think we're really in a lucky position right now because so many people for decades have been working to build this wonderful resource that is the global tree ring data set. And so much of that data set is publicly available for anyone to use if they can wrestle it from the somewhat unusual tree ring format into something that's a little easier to work with. But I think it opens up a lot of possibilities for making these kind of comparisons and really exploiting the full power of a very large network that has emerged after decades of decades of people going out and taking a small forestry tool and pulling out a small piece of the history of that tree to take back into the lab.
Scott St. George from the University of Minnesota is working to bring the vast network of tree rings into the era of modern climate dynamics. Scott, thank you so much for the chat.
Thanks, Mike. It was really fun.
That was my interview with Scott St. George from the University of Minnesota. Scott, thanks very much for the chat. You can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are at forecastpod.org, and you can subscribe to the show via iTunes. It's also available on Stitcher and Google Play Music. Subscribing is nice because you'll get the show right away, and otherwise it could take who knows how long to actually show up on iTunes. And on iTunes, you can also leave reviews on the show, which is super helpful to increase the visibility to people who might be searching for things like climate podcast. The next interview coming up on Forecast will be with Amelia Chevenel from the University of South Florida, chatting about things like the Miocene and the dynamic nature of the Antarctic ice sheet. Talk to you soon.